The last investigator I chatted with was Dr. Matt Ellis, and to begin, you presented an interesting patient from his practice.
A 55-year-old patient with metastatic breast cancer. An earlier biopsy had established that it was hormone receptor positive, and the standard HER2 testing was negative, that is to say the protein was not apparently overexpressed by immunohistochemistry, and the FISH testing was negative. She went on to receive endocrine therapy, but the disease unfortunately progressed in both bones, and when she was rescanned, she had new-onset liver mets. It's become my practice to biopsy liver mets because a small number of these liver mets can show changes in the standard markers, ER and HER2. And now we have a clinical trial which also focuses on a new finding, which is the acquisition of mutations in the HER2 gene in either the kinase domain or the heterodimerization interface. And so on a clinical trial, we screened her case and found that she had a mutation called V777L in the HER2 kinase domain. And this is a known activation mutation for HER2 in vitro. And so she was considered for the clinical trial.
What actually happens on the clinical trial?
Well, it's an interesting story, Neil. The presence of mutations in HER2 has been known for some time, but the screening efforts to really understand what the exact profile of these mutations are in breast cancer really awaited the next-gen sequencing bonanza that occurred during the course of 2012. So by around August, September, we knew the identity of about 25 mutations in HER2 from TCGA, our own sequencing efforts, and other publications. And we modeled these mutations, that is to say, we made the mutations and put them in indicator cell lines, and found that many of them were indeed activating. There's been similar findings in lung cancer. I think we were discussing that earlier. And so the question is, would these patients now respond to targeted therapy? So we did the molecular pharmacology, and essentially the small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors, lapatinib, and one that's still in clinical development called neuratinib, are both active against these mutations. Although interestingly, some of them, not V777L, but others, appear to be natural lapatinib resistance mutations. And so obviously those patients might be better treated with neuratinib.
What about trastuzumab?
Well, this has been a debate that I've had with several people recently, is what the role of trastuzumab would be in the treatment of these mutations. The first thing to say is, of course, in general, these mutations are occurring in tumors that are not overexpressing HER2. So the question is, trastuzumab, which is targeting overexpressed HER2, how effective would it be, or does it have a contributory pharmacological effect, perhaps in combination with the HER2 targeting agent, and we just don't know at this point. It's too early. The challenge for the treatment of HER2 mutant breast cancer is that you have to find these patients. We don't actually know the incidence of this mutation class in metastatic breast cancer, because unfortunately, the next-gen sequencing efforts have largely focused on primary untreated breast cancer. And so there's another TCGA-like effort that needs to be taken in metastatic breast cancer. In primary breast cancer, the incidence rate's about 1.6%, which sounds like a small number, but remember, the denominator for breast cancer is huge. So in fact, the HER2 mutant breast cancer numbers could easily be equivalent to the annual incidence of something like chronic myeloid leukemia. So 4,000 to 5,000 patients a year. And I suspect from the cases that I have heard of, because of course, once we published our paper in Cancer Discovery and presented the results at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, other people who'd been sequencing breast cancers called us up and say, hey, what do you think about this patient with this mutation? And it would seem, and my first impression at least, is that these mutations are associated with very aggressive type breast cancer because the cases tend to be patients with brain mets, for example, or liver mets, almost like they had untreated HER2 positive breast cancer. That is to say, untreated in the sense they'd never received a HER2 targeting agent. So it may be that in the metastatic setting, it's more frequent than 1% or 2%. So this patient was part of a screen. She was the first of perhaps 10 patients where we had data. So, you know, who knows what it's going to be? It could easily be higher in the target population, which is metastatic disease.
And did this lady receive anti-HER treatment?
Well, it's a bit of a sad story because unfortunately she wasn't eligible for the trial because she was too sick by the time that we identified her mutation. Pretty soon after this, she was found to have developed brain metastases. But she's currently being treated with lapatinib because fortunately this particular mutation, in vitro at least, is lapatinib sensitive. And obviously, given the story I just gave you, you appreciate the patient's still struggling. So I'd say that at this point, not recommending the treatment of HER2 mutations with lapatinib or trastuzumab outside the context of a clinical trial. I mean, this is a very important point, right? We've defined a new disease entity here, and we have to do rigorous clinical trials to identify the risks and benefits of giving them HER2-directed treatment. But of course, it's hopeful that this might be a new way to treat a population with initially metastatic disease.
I have been hearing about this from lung cancer investigators, particularly Mark Crisp, but it's not clear whether or not there have actually been patients with lung cancer treated and whether they've responded. And I'd ask you the same thing in terms of breast cancer. Are there any reported cases that actually have been treated and responded who were, you know, not HER2 amplified but had one of these mutations?
Not yet, but we have a trial. It's with neratinib. We're screening populations for this mutation. And I think we'll know within the next 6 to 9 months whether the first stage of our Simon two-stage phase two is showing an efficacy signal.
You know, it also kind of leads into the question of, does anti-HER therapy benefit any patients who don't have HER2 amplification in general? You know, you have the big NSABP trial out there trying to look at people with, I guess, HER2 2+. Do you think that maybe mechanisms like this might explain that? And do you think that there might be clinical responses observed in patients who are conventionally HER2 negative?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is I don't know that the presence of these mutations could explain the kinds of observations that Soon-Paik has made regarding the possible efficacy of trastuzumab in so-called HER2-negative breast cancer. I think one of the theories that's floating around there, supported in part by studies of HER2 expression in disseminated cells and the occasional observation of a true HER2-amplified case, say, in a liver met where the primary was negative, is that breast cancer is constantly evolving. And so there's either a HER2-positive subclone that was missed or a subclone that subsequently evolved HER2 mutation, and they're more likely to be disseminated. And that's the population you're sort of targeting in the so-called HER2-negative group. So this tumor heterogeneity issue could perhaps explain the efficacy of trastuzumab. The alternative theory is that HER2 has some special function perhaps in cancer stem cells, and they are somehow addicted to the HER signaling pathway, and that's what you're targeting with trastuzumab in so-called HER2 normal cases. It may be a combination of things. I think that's a very brave and important experiment that the NSABP are doing. I think it's a little bit, perhaps, a deficiency of the trial. There's not aggressive sort of biopsying and plasma DNA analysis and a whole variety of sort of attempts at further defining who the sensitive population might be. But those kinds of studies are very expensive, and it may be that perhaps what we're looking at is that if Soon is right and there is a signal for HER2 efficacy in so-called HER2 negative, and I think you'd have to say mutation negative tumors at this point, that'll spawn further investigation into the question. Certainly for now, we shouldn't be giving trastuzumab to HER2 negative cases.
So I want to ask you about your other two cases, but first, sort of relevant to what you were just talking about, I wanted to let you know that actually what prompted me to contact you to do this interview and another in a series of you and I've done was an email I got from a Dr. Bert Gold from the NCI saying, "I'm strongly urging you to interview Dr. Matthew Ellis in your next breast cancer update. I just got back from an NIH conference on, quote, defining clinical utility of molecular diagnostics for cancer treatment. And in my mind, he was the star of the meeting." So tell me about this meeting. It sounds like it had a very, you know, broad general purpose. I'm curious what was discussed. And, you know, sort of what the messages are right now that came out of that meeting that you think are important for docs in practice to know about.
Well, there are two aspects to this. One, I can make some comments that don't involve a conflict of interest, and another that does. So let's deal with the one I don't. One of the conversations was about companion diagnostics, and I think HER2 mutation testing could be an example there. I think classically what the FDA is considering is a sort of companion diagnostic with every targeted therapy, which sounds good in theory. So, for example, there would be a testing box for HER2 mutation. And then if that mutation is found, then the patient would receive a drug and we would know something about the likelihood of response to that drug. The problem with that is that when you're searching for a relatively rare mutation like V777L or similar HER2 mutations or perhaps BRAF mutations in breast cancer, you're going to have to buy a lot of those boxes if that's the primary screening purpose. You know, you'd have to have one box for one mutation class, another box for another mutation class, a third box for another mutation class. So you had to screen for BRAF, HER2, and PI3 kinase mutations or something. You can imagine you'd accumulate very large numbers of boxes, and it would be an incredibly inefficient way to screen for these patients. So one thing I was pleading for was some kind of next-gen sequencing assay that would sequence patients for all these things in an unbiased way, and then maybe these little boxes are used just for the validation experiment. Because we really have to think about where the future's going and how to efficiently create a diagnostic paradigm that, one, is not overwhelmingly expensive, and two, is efficient. So that was one of the comments I made. The other comments where I do have a conflict centered around models where there were multiple genes in the model. Obviously, that would include things like the 21-gene recurrence score. And the other one that was discussed is the PAM50 test, which there's my conflict because I have some involvement in the patenting and commercialization of that. And I think that that's an ongoing debate. I mean, without making any comments about the relative benefit of those two tests, I just make the general comment that these tests still don't have a very secure regulatory framework. The Oncotype test remains a sort of one-site homebrew test. And that may be fine, but it's not a solution to breast cancer as a global problem. So one of the things that I was discussing is how do we develop a test that can be broadly used throughout the world? In general, how can we get some of these next-gen sort of gene analysis platforms approved for whether it's gene expression or whether it's sequencing? And obviously, that's a very big target for the FDA to think about.
Let's talk a little bit about neoadjuvant treatment, an area you've been very involved with. And I'm particularly interested in your current efforts with a so-called alternate trial.
So this is using the Ki-67 proliferation index as a monitoring technique for the efficacy of the endocrine drug. So if we all accept endocrine therapy as maintenance therapy, for most maintenance therapies in medicine, we have some kind of surrogate biomarker. So, you know, I happen to have a problem with my cholesterol. It's hereditary. I take a drug, it lowers my cholesterol level, and every now and again, we'll have a cholesterol test to make sure, you know, the drug's working. Same with blood pressure, same with diabetes. But for hormone receptor positive breast cancer, all these patients take this maintenance therapy. They have no idea whether it's being effective or not. So my idea, obviously not just mine, but certainly Mitch Dowsett's the other champion here, the idea that you could start an endocrine drug, the predominant effect of the drug is to arrest the cell cycle. So why not measure something quite simple to see if the estrogen deprivation therapy was successfully causing cell cycle arrest? And so what Mitch found and what I found, and many of our studies, we collaborated on this earlier on, we did find that tumors in whom the Ki-67 did not fall had a much worse prognosis than tumors in whom the estrogen deprivation essentially caused the Ki-67 to drop to zero. Because, of course, you know, you've got one case, the drug's been effective, the estrogen deprivation caused cell cycle arrest, and the other case, the estrogen deprivation did not. Pretty simple thinking. So the idea of the alternate trial is to now take that into a validation phase. The first sort of primary objective, which could be done with just plain Jane aromatase inhibitor like anastrozole or letrozole, would be to give the drug monitor. And then the patients who had a lack of Ki-67 suppression, and you can make this measurement 2 to 4 weeks into the start of the drug where the estrogen deprivation is now fully established, if the Ki-67 is still high, you take them off the endocrine therapy and you give them chemotherapy. So that's cohort A, if you like, the ones who are showing acute kinetic resistance to endocrine therapy. The second group of patients, can we take the extreme responders and treat them without chemotherapy? So those are patients who are node negative, the tumor's shrunk, it's small, and the Ki-67 is fully suppressed. We call those PEPI zeros for preoperative endocrine prognostic index, PEPI zeros. Can we then follow those without chemotherapy, just endocrine therapy. And then the idea for those, they have extremely low relapse incidence at 5 years. And if we show that, then we'll assume that that's a safe way to identify the most sensitive population. And then in the alternate trial, we've mixed that question with the question of which neoadjuvant endocrine therapy to give. And so the randomization is between anastrozole, fulvestrant at the high dose, or the combination of the two. Because there's data in the metastatic setting that the combination of anastrozole plus fulvestrant, albeit at the lower dose, the 250 dose, was more effective, particularly in untreated patients or first-line metastatic disease, than the control arm, which was anastrozole alone. So the endpoint of the randomization is actually the number of patients who experience PEPI zero. Because the more patients you get into that extreme responder category, the fewer you need to treat with chemotherapy, if you can catch my drift there. So that's the idea of the trial. Right now, because of changes in the FDA with respect to something called an investigational device exemption, we're working very hard with a diagnostics company to make a really rigorous Ki-67 test, which is not quite so sort of dependent on the pathologist counting cells down the microscope, but involves a scanner. And as long as we're successful in those investigational device exemption experiments, the trial's going to go ahead. But that's the last thing we have to fix. And that won't be a surprise to anybody. Anyone who listened to Torsten Nielsen's talk on Ki-67 at San Antonio will know that there's a problem with Ki-67 in terms of the way it's counted and how to get an objective result. So we're trying to rapidly solve that problem with this scanner.
Could you just sort of summarize, because Ki-67 kind of has gotten sort of a bad name, so to speak, what the key problem is that leads to the variation?
Well, like with all diagnostic tests, in actual fact, I don't think Ki-67 is particularly worse than, you know, the other offenders we have in our diagnostic spectrum. But, you know, obviously with any immunohistochemical test, there's variation in the quality of the staining. So the staining has to be properly controlled, which usually means a kit and not homebrews. Because if you do homebrew, obviously, you know, different antibodies, different incubation times will give you different results. And the other thing which people have difficulty with is heterogeneity of staining. So, you know, the staining can be patchy. But the same thing is true to HER2, and the same thing is also true for ER. These are generic issues with immunohistochemical tests. And so working with Craig Allred and our, you know, industrial partner, we think that the scanner is a good way of solving this, because with the scanner you can count thousands of cells, whereas a human eye can't and is more objective. So if that works out, I think we've solved some of the problems here. But because of the difficulty in counting, it's, you know, visual counting plus the problem of using a homebrew, I think has caused some of these difficulties that, you know, are pretty familiar with other markers. But it doesn't mean to say that at the extremes, that is to say, the tumor's just gone plumb Ki-67 negative because the drug's working, or it's plumb high, that's pretty robust biology. It's really the problem that becomes in the sort of gray zone case, because you're making a binary decision, perhaps whether to give the patient chemotherapy and call them refractory or not, or not giving them chemotherapy because the result is low. But I think my read of it right now is we should be able to push forward and do this big validation study in the alternate trial. And I'm hopeful that in the end, Ki-67 will enter practice in a much more robust and confident way.
I know there are proliferation markers, at least in the Oncotype. What about using, you know, RT-PCR type approach to proliferation?
Well, in general, there's these things called proliferation signatures that measure not just Ki-67, but also a variety of other markers that are required for cell cycle progression. And I know, I think they have their place. And indeed, as you say, that in these molecular signatures, they often feature very dominantly. I think what my reading of the literature is these proliferation signatures are quite good at predicting early relapse. But what they're not good at doing is predicting late relapse. The late relapse problem doesn't seem to directly relate to the proliferation index of the tumor, interestingly. So I think that we're sort of measuring different biologies with these multigene tests and sort of integrating them in some mysterious way. But certainly, how fast is the tumor growing is obviously, we've known that, is predictive for many years. And there's different ways to measure it. And I think that Ki-67 is one way, and I think a proliferation signature is another. And we can cross-compete these things and see which is better. But I think that we have to be careful when they do those kinds of comparisons because, you know, we're not always comparing apples and oranges in terms of the state that the assay technique is at. For example, you know, if you compare immunohistochemistry for Ki-67 versus a proliferation signature, actually, usually the proliferation signatures win. But maybe that's because the Ki-67 wasn't done well. So this is an ongoing debate that will, I think, be a pretty hot topic for conversation for the next 4 or 5 years.
So this alternate trial type approach really has a lot of appeal. I mean, it's very intuitive. Now, you've talked before about looking at mTOR inhibitors, maybe CDK inhibitors in the adjuvant setting in terms of path CR. But what about, you know, integrating those kinds of agents into this type of platform where, you know, really looking more for drops and proliferation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, in fact, that's exactly what we're doing. So the trial that we currently have, half of the trial active and the other half will get active pretty soon, is it's the neoadjuvant setting, ER-positive, HER2-negative. The patients start on the endocrine drug. We got a month there in which we can do the molecular profiling. If they're PI3 kinase mutant, they're going to get a PI3 kinase pathway targeting agent. In the first phase of this, it's going to be an AKT inhibitor, which we spent 2 years working out how to give with endocrine therapy in the metastatic setting. And the idea then, we'll treat 11 or 12 patients, and if we have a path CR, we go on. And if we don't have a path CR, we'll give some other drug to the PI3 kinase mutant population, in endeavoring to find ones that are highly effective in that population. But part and parcel of that decision, is it working, would be a biopsy a couple of weeks into the PI3 kinase inhibitor, aromatase inhibitor population, to see if the tumor's fallen further from the 1 month point. So they obviously get the pre-op biopsy to do the genome sequencing, the 1 month biopsy to see the efficacy of the endocrine drug alone, and you give the second drug to target the second part of the story, which is the PI3 kinase mutant. Then you biopsy again to see if the proliferation index has fallen further, and indeed whether you've induced cell death markers. And then on the other arm, it's the same thing, except it's the PI3 kinase wild type population, and they get the CDK4/6 inhibitor. So the idea of all this is that we do clinical investigation, but in a setting where we can get surrogate markers for efficacy and also deeply look at the tumor and how it's responding to treatment to try and understand which drugs we should take forward into larger studies.
So you mentioned a couple of issues, and combination of an aromatase inhibitor, fulvestrant, and also everolimus. And I'm just kind of curious, taking a step back from the research, but looking into current practice, in what situations, if any, right now, are you utilizing those two strategies outside a trial setting, AI and fulvestrant and everolimus?
So I frequently treat metastatic ER-positive breast cancer, and essentially the decisions I'm making are highly personalized, in that you have to take a lot of things into account to make a good decision for the patient. A lot of it's to do with the level of confidence I have that the patient's going to be an endocrine therapy responder. So if I see a patient who, you know, has a solitary or just one or two bone mets and they're relatively asymptomatic, I might do something very simple, like just give them an aromatase inhibitor. If they have more aggressive disease, or, you know, they've got some low volume visceral disease, first line, I'm going to quite likely think about fulvestrant with anastrozole or indeed another aromatase inhibitor. And I reserve the everolimus for patients who need chemo light. I've had arguments with people about everolimus. It's not a targeted therapy. That's a shocking thing to say. Everyone goes, what do you mean by that, Dr. Ellis? Well, targeted therapy is when you measure the target and you give a drug against that target. I mean, a good example would be imatinib for the treatment of CML. The target there is obviously a translocation that activates the Abl kinase. And you give an Abl kinase inhibitor and the patient gets better. So you measured, you gave the targeted drug. Well, everolimus, you don't do that. There's nothing we measure in the tumor to say it's the, you don't measure mTOR, we don't measure PI3 kinase. And that was kind of what I was getting back in the next case. I was going to argue for this. We don't measure anything in the tumor to make a decision as to whether to give everolimus. The second thing is everolimus is a natural product. It comes from the bacteria found in the soil of Easter Island. That's why it's called Rapa, because it's the Rapa Nui people of Easter Island that it was named after. So it's in the same class of anti-tumor antibiotic that doxorubicin falls into, you know, other natural products like paclitaxel, for example. So we know in general what its target is, like we know that paclitaxel inhibits microtubules in the mitotic spindle. But we don't measure that in tumors to make decisions about paclitaxel, and we don't measure TOR to make decisions about everolimus. So it is targeted in that we understand the mechanism, but we're not targeting the drug with a test. And I think we need to develop a test to make a better decision. So in my practice, the patients who I use everolimus in would be the patients who've been through first-line endocrine therapy, typically the populations that were in the BOLERO-2 trial, and they're using it as salvage because their disease is becoming symptomatic and the burdens of the toxicity of everolimus are justified because the patient's now got an unpleasant problem.
What is your clinical experience in terms of side effects, particularly the mucositis and toxicity? Have you seen any pneumonitis?
So we go backwards through those questions. Yes, I have seen everolimus-induced pneumonitis. All my patients on everolimus have a walking pulse ox as part of their vital signs in my clinic. The one or two cases I have seen it is when the everolimus has been started right on the back of some prior cytotoxic chemotherapy. And so I'd recommend to everybody they consider a washout before they start the everolimus. So one patient really had dramatic pneumonitis. She just finished a course of capecitabine and then she felt short of breath and she had fluffy infiltrates and an oxygenation problem, which resolved. I had to give her some corticosteroids. But, you know, I just caution that a washout might be important. I don't know that, but I'd recommend that given on my clinical experience. But overall, I've found that the pneumonitis problem is relatively uncommon, but you definitely need to know about it, and you definitely need to investigate patients who are having cough or shortness of breath. With respect to the mucositis, it's amazing to me how variable it is. I think patients who, for example, had, let's say, radiation to the head and neck or have just finished a drug which can be associated with mucositis, again, implying some kind of recall effect, seem to have more mucositis than average. But the trick there is a steroid mouthwash, and they can use it either in a targeted way if they got a little crop of ulcers and they can just put the steroid directly onto that little patch, or if they've got more extensive mucositis, they definitely just stop the drug and swish, but spit the corticosteroid mouthwash, and that seems to work. The rash is mild, not usual problem, can be itchy, and again, a little topical 100% hydrocortisone cream seems to help. And the other thing is some patients get quite a lot of GI upset, don't feel like eating, sort of bowel issues, sort of not exactly diarrhea, but bellyache, although some patients do get frank diarrhea. And again, that's something you have to stop. You can find patients can rapidly lose weight, I've found, on everolimus when they're not tolerating it well from a GI perspective. So it's not a super easy drug to use, I would say, but if used carefully, some patients need the reduction from 10 to 5 milligrams, for example. You know, some patients actually, I think, are doing quite well on it. I got maybe 4 or 5 patients at this point who've gone beyond 6 months on it and seem to have disease control.
So there is a trial now that's going to look at everolimus for 1 year in the adjuvant setting. What are your thoughts, first of all, about the theoretical basis of doing the study and then the practical issues of getting somebody in the adjuvant setting through 1 year?
Well, we used to give CMF for 1 year, right? I remember that, Neil. I don't know. We'll see. I think the study is your sort of classic medical oncology study. You know, something is found to be active in the metastatic setting and you give it in the adjuvant setting. In this case, again, in a relatively untargeted way, I think they're choosing higher risk patients and that's logical. But that's about it. So I think when you're giving drugs in the adjuvant setting, it's nice to see cures, right? That's the idea of giving these drugs broadly. You're increasing the cure rate, you're increasing the survival rate. And I hope they see that. They might not. And the reason why I say that is there was a trial, I think it was called RAD222 or something. It was a study presented by Jose Bazalga, and it was a neoadjuvant study of letrozole versus letrozole everolimus. And you didn't see an increase in the path CR rate. In other words, you got an anti-proliferative effect, but you get an anti-proliferative effect with aromatase inhibitor alone that's quite potent. And you added to that a little bit with the everolimus, which was good to see. But you didn't see, you know, dramatic increases in tumor regression, which we all know can be associated with cure. So I think my prediction for that trial is, you know, who knows? But it might show a PFS improvement, but it might not show an overall survival improvement. And then the debate's going to be, you know, how valuable is this treatment?
You know, another thing about this study that I thought was interesting is that they actually incorporate a recurrence score and they factor that into whether the patient gets into the study in some situations. And, you know, clearly that is one way to get more events, so to speak, or higher risk people. But I was curious also whether or not the elements that are looked in the recurrence score, in your view, might in some way predict responsiveness to adding an mTOR inhibitor.
I think there might be measuring response measures for the CDK4/6 inhibitor, actually, because if you look at the TCGA data, those high proliferation luminal Bs are more likely to have the CDK4/6 cyclin DRB mechanism than they are to have PI3 kinase mutations. I mean, at this point, we're all guessing, right? So they're using the recurrence score there strictly in the prognostic sense. They're not using it in the predictive sense. But my understanding, my molecular biology, you know, it could be that you're actually selecting for patients who'd be poorly responsive. Who knows, right?
Well, also, you know, higher recurrence score, to my thinking, also denotes less innate hormone responsiveness.
Right. So if there's synergy there, you might not see it. So this is all obviously pure speculation. And the study will go ahead and it will speak for itself. I'm obviously supportive of the study. And I think it's a SWOG-NSABP collaboration. I think that's a good thing that large cooperative groups are working together on it. And my only plea would be to make sure that we get as much tumor tissue as we can from these studies. Because the killer for me from this, what I've now sort of, you know, like to think about as the drug statistics biology approach of investigation. And by that, I mean, you know, there's a drug of interest, you give it to a bunch of patients in a randomized trial, that's the statistics. And then many years later, you sort of retrospectively try and work out who the responders and who weren't. That style of investigation, of course, can work, but you need a really complete representation of the trial and the tissue blocks. And increasingly, that's been a problem. And of course, that is close to clinical investigation, the exact opposite to what we were talking about for the HER2 mutations, for example. They're the biologies first, you find the mutations, you give the drug, and the statistics speak for themselves because you're looking for a large effect. And, you know, my own instincts are to go sort of in the latter direction where we can.
One more thing about ER-positive disease, which is I wanted to get your take on the ATLAS trial that was presented at San Antonio looking at 10 years of tamoxifen. Can you talk a little bit about what was seen there and what you think it means?
Well, I'll just give you sort of the general synopsis I give to my fellows. We discussed earlier that endocrine therapy is maintenance therapy, right? And so, you know, a lot of patients have dormant metastatic disease because they're taking an endocrine drug. So the higher risk the patient has disseminated disease, the higher risk the patient has that dormant disease, the more benefit they will get from long-term maintenance with endocrine drugs. And so obviously what ATLAS told us is this decision that 5 years of tamoxifen was enough was based on inadequate data. 5 years of tamoxifen probably isn't enough, particularly in high-risk populations. But of course, that 5 years is enough opened the window for MA17 and Paul Goss's study, which allowed us to take a five-year patient and randomize their treatment to observation versus letrozole. And in my mind, that was a hugely practice-changing study. And now we have the ATLAS trial that really says the following thing. In my view, if you have high-risk breast cancer, node-positive disease, a large primary, high recurrence score, whatever you decide puts a patient in a high-risk category, I would say that 5 years of endocrine therapy is inadequate. And I would say that the new standard is much more like 10 years. And we have MA17R that's even looking at letrozole beyond 10 years. It might be a long time before we know that result. But in general, I think it matters less what you're taking. What matters, you're taking something in the long term. And I think that in practice, we all find that patients tolerate an aromatase inhibitor, tamoxifen better, and I just try and keep the patient on something. Because that's a long time to be on a drug. And as we all know, there's a sort of compliance problem with these drugs. Patients often are not taking it beyond year 4, year 5. And I think oncologists have to be diligent, and they have to be seeing these patients in the long term and trying to keep them on their drug. And that usually means all sorts of clever supportive care and a lot of talk therapy to encourage them to keep taking it And I think this whole thing, you know, where you would say, well, after 5 years, I don't need to see you anymore, Mrs. Smith. I think really we have to get away from that, and we have to help these patients in the long term to reduce their late relapse risk.
So for practical purposes, I'm curious how you approach the following. First, a woman who's premenopausal starts on tamoxifen, and 5 years later, she's still premenopausal.
Well, again, this is a little bit risk adaptive, but in general, premenopausal ER-positive disease, I actually find quite scary. And Paul Goss's data will tell you that the patients who benefit from letrozole the most were the younger premenopausal and certainly node-positive patients. And so, obviously, once you're at 5 years, you know, the typically presenting 35, 40-year-old is now 45 or 40, and decisions about having a family and things are usually fixed in most patients by the time they're 40. And some of those patients will actually accept oophorectomy. And for those, if I think they're at high risk, I discuss that with them. If they're not, I offer them continued tamoxifen therapy.
If you do the oophorectomy, will you then put the patient on an AI?
Yeah, I do. You know, but people are going to argue with me about this. But I think the argument has to be made with the individual patients.
So is that what you do in general from the beginning, though, with the premenopausal patient?
Not necessarily. I think the jury is still out. Of course, a bunch of patients will get chemotherapy-induced menopause. And the whole issue of using aromatase inhibitors versus tamoxifen in that setting needs to be resolved. One of the things I was quite impressed by is the sort of controversy around the gazerolin anastrozole data. I talked to Mitch at length about this, and we both worry. And I think there was a study called the STAGE study from Japan. I don't know if you saw that, but the STAGE study was using anastrozole and gazerolin in the neoadjuvant setting in premenopausal women. And it looked like from the estradiol levels that women receiving gazerolin anastrozole had a tachyphylaxis to the gazerolin, where the estradiol levels were creeping up during the course of the neoadjuvant treatment, and you weren't seeing that with tamoxifen. So I think that my problem, and you can see this actually in the large Austrian trial of anastrozole, is that for whatever reason, the combination of the AI and the LHRHA may not be a good one. And the pituitary gonadal reflex is actually sort of kicking in and superactivating the ovarian estrogen production to the point where both drugs are becoming ineffective. So I'm not a big fan of aromatase inhibitor gazerolin. I treat them with tamoxifen, and until they're permanently menopausal, never consider aromatase inhibitor. And some cases, special cases, lots of positive nodes, for example, in a patient who's willing to have an oophorectomy, I'd consider that.